Okay, let's want to get that door loud. Somehow everyone's here like 5 minutes early. But never mind. Seems early. Just to remind you that tomorrow night at the workshop, we have Amy Allen from Dartmouth, who's talking about critical theory and gender, kind of, I guess, a preview of a forthcoming book. So it should be a terrific occasion. She's really a wonderful philosopher. Okay, I'm certainly going to try to finish the introduction today. I have to finish it at some point. And move on to the first moment of quality. So far, we've looked at, in a broad way, three forms of reflective judgment. Yikes. Namely, reflective judgment with respect to system, the idea of natural science as requiring a horizon of a unified system, the idea of reflective judgment concerning concept formation, so that bit of reflecting necessary. When faced with new particulars, to see what concept may be formed from it or them, and how it may go. And then finally, I ended last time by talking about reflection on living systems or organisms. And what, of course, all these share is the production of concepts of a certain kind. And my hypothesis was that the character when we ended last week, I was concerned that Kant's way of thinking about concepts in general didn't seem to leave space for the idea of recognizing things as living. And I at least suggested the hypothesis that in order to recognize something as living, that the predicate is living may be a material a priori predicate, and that it's certainly unlike ordinary predicates that we use to talk about empirical objects. Now, in saying that all these push towards concept, this is not the case with aesthetic reflection, or what Kant sometimes calls mere reflection. For mere reflection on an object, or aesthetic reflection, produces not a concept, but a feeling. A feeling, above all, of pleasure, or, if it's a nasty thing, displeasure. Now, this does make aesthetic reflective judgments unlike these others. And it's in thinking about that unlikeness that I want to, as it were, focus our attention. In the first introduction, in paragraph 7, Kant gives us his analysis of mere reflection. Now, the subtext of this whole discussion is the necessity for there to be a harmony of the faculties of imagination and understanding. The understanding is the faculty of concepts, and at least here, the imagination is the faculty of that engages directly with intuitions, and the job of the imagination is the apprehending of intuitions, while the job of the understanding is the comprehending. Of those same intuitions, and you comprehend something by bringing it under a concept. So the goal of ordinary cognitive activity is to bring an intuition under a concept, to recognize it as such and such, as a cup, or recognize it that the cup is red, or whatever. In apprehension, which is what we talked about kind of ad nauseum last week, what we do is a work of what I called passive synthesis. And in the work of passive synthesis, we prepare the intuition for conceptualization by seeking out both its unitary character, what features make it one thing, one event, one object, and what are the crucial discriminating characteristics. Of that unitary presentation. So what we're doing is taking a manifold. Manifold is simply Kant's word for complexity, for manyness. We're taking is an intuitional manifold and beginning the business of thinking it as somehow united or as one. And the example I want you to keep in mind when we think about this, in order to keep us kind of focused on the aesthetic case, and in order to keep us in that world of intuitional recognition, your paradigm case should be looking at a Pollock painting. Because looking at a Pollock painting is exactly a difficulty of trying to see what is before you. You're not going to try to apply concepts to it and say, oh, you know, of course you can play the game, do I see a hand? Or no, that's not the way you look at it, right? You're going to try to figure out in what way, if any, somehow this thing, which seems at first to be a disorganized mess, somehow has some coherence to it. That this manyness, right, is a coherent or unified manyness. And in your looking at a Pollock, because you can't really do much conceptual work, you really are doing an imaginative work of appraising, examining, attending, looking for what we called last week significant patternings, significant structures, significant movement and relations of movement. Now, in a certain way, And again, this is a kind of conceit I want you to use. In a certain way, I want you to think that when we engage with any object in the world, our first encounter with it is like engaging with a Pollock painting. It's like a situation of examining something that is an indeterminate something for which we do not know quite what it is, and the first thing we have to do is sort of imaginatively apprehend it, somehow imaginatively gather in what ways it could conceivably be a one thing and not merely a many mess. Right? It may be a many mess. On the weekend I was in Boston and they had number 2 from 1950, which is a long, narrow one, which I hadn't thought hard about before, and I wasn't sure. Right? I just did. I only didn't have much time. Maybe, I don't know, right? So, don't know if it's even rises to the level of, okay? Now, this is to say that in any encounter with an object, we have to go through this imaginative, synthetic work. And in doing so, again, we are preparing the object, right? To be comprehended. So it's as if the work of the imagination anticipates what is going to happen when the understanding kicks in and says, it's a green turtle. In that sense, the relationship between imagination and the understanding is a coordination of these two faculties. The one dealing with concepts, the other dealing with sensory presentation, and the imagination that has to be necessarily, for any empirical judgment, there has to be a harmony of the imagination and the understanding. And the great topic of the third critique in part is just this question of the harmony between imagination and understanding in general. Whatever the hell that means. In general is the puzzle. Come to it. Okay, so in some sense, Kant's aesthetics has something to do with how these faculties of the mind work together, but not work together. Okay. So now we have to think about what it means to talk about the relationship between the imagination and the understanding in two different respects. In respect of a cognitive reflection on the one hand, and in respect of a mere or aesthetic reflection on the other hand. Both cases are going to be about this relationship, and we've got to kind of figure out how they are similar or different. Well, let's begin with the standard empirical case, where the harmony between understanding and imagination is for the sake of the recognition of what is thought in a concept. And what is thought in a concept is something that must be presented or exhibited in a corresponding intuition. Which is to say, on the one hand, we're moving in the opposite direction now. I'm saying, if you've got a concept elephant, you must, in order to actually have the concept, as we discussed last week, you must be able to know what it would be to present or exhibit that concept, right, in sensory experience. So you must have the idea of, you know, the big four-legged thing with the trunk and all that kind of stuff. Have that capacity to understand that image as the schema, right? That image is the general schema for the concept elephant. And therefore, to have an understanding of a concept is to say you can produce or exhibit such schemas. And to say that is to say that you can produce them or exhibit them in the imagination. Right? The imagination is where that exhibition or presentation of the concept occurs. Now, in thinking about any object, this is kind of Henry Allison's conceit, which is not an unhelpful way of getting started. We might say that we can imagine three types of cases. And these three types of cases give us the beginning of what it is to talk about the relationship between the understanding and the imagination in general. So the first type of case is one in which the understanding can be too universal. That is, someone says to you, "Oh, what's that?" And you say, "Oh, it's an object." Right? And you might say, "Well, I, you know. Now, the point here is that just to say it's an object, that is, it has that level of unity of coherence and time and place, causality, is almost to say nothing about it whatsoever, but it is to say something. And in order to say something, we're not home. In order to say something, there must be, and this is the point, a minimal harmony between the imagination and the understanding. That the understanding's basic categories, its concept of an object in general, that something is a substance, it's somewhere and some when in causal interaction, these are satisfied by what is imaginatively grasped. Now, you know, take a difficult and more complicated case where I present to you some green, red, oozy, slightly quiver, you know, so on and so forth, at which point you may say, "Well, I'm not even sure that's anything, right? I'm not sure that's a one thing at all. It could be just almost a mess." In which case, we might say that the object is too irregular or idiosyncratic for conceptualization. Now, we don't yet know how to think of it as either 1 or 17, as either red all the way through or green all the way. You know, we don't have any way. So at this point, there's a failure. We have a kind of imaginative awareness, but there's no unity to it, and so it doesn't set up the possibilities of conceptualization. Right? We're just kind of flummoxed. So we can have minimal harmony or disharmony, which may, we'll have to talk about this, have something to do with the ugly, what the ugly might mean. And then we might think now of a third possibility, where we imagine that not
merely, can we say something minimal, but we can say we're often impressed when we read a novel and someone takes something like a cup of coffee and just gives you the sense of the feel, the taste, it's all there, in which both all the sensory complexity and its unitary character is suddenly juts out. We want to say in that case what we feel is there's a maximum harmony between imaginative complexity and richness with detail and fineness of grain and conceptual understanding, that we can say something about the whole thing and how the bits and pieces fit together. And I'm imagining that as a type of, you might say, a deep description of the object. Okay, those are different types of cases of empirical reflection. Empirical judgments in which different relationships between the imagination and the understanding occur. What, on the basis of this, can we ask, what is mere reflection? What does aesthetic reflection do? And on consequent, what is absolutely fundamental to aesthetic judging is absolutely not for the sake of bringing an object under a concept. It is a judgment without a concept, which is why I want you to just keep in mind the Pollock painting. I'm not saying that the Pollock painting, I want to say, is as true of Pollock eventually as it is of a Rembrandt or of a Zola novel. Right? Eventually, all these things have to be understood as aesthetic and therefore judgment without a concept. Even though in the cases of the Rembrandt and the Zola novel, we're going to be using tons of concepts. That's just going to confuse you. Forget about that for now. Think about Pollock alone. But remember that art covers a lot of cases. So what we're going to look for in a mere reflection or an aesthetic reflection is an intuitive content in what is perceived, which is prior to and independent of any conceptualization or any comparison with other perceptions, and which contains or presents itself as containing something that is, well, that's the puzzle. As something that has, and now I'm just going to use the loose and ready phrase, some type of intuitive, I don't mean that word, intuitional coherence. That is, it presents itself as a unified manyness. Or, to use the phrasing we were using last week, it presents itself somehow as presenting something perhaps universal in itself. Remember that phrase? Or a schema, but not a schema, because a schema is a schema of a concept. So, and we can't even have undetermined concepts. So the best we can do is say it presents itself as something schema-like, as if governed by a rule, although no actual rule is given. That is,
and this will, that very definition will turn out to be also the definition of genius.
It's something that appears to us
to have what I'm calling a high level of intuitional coherence, but that coherence is not thought of, and ideally
is unthinkable as being intuitive, as following from a rule. So there is something that presents itself as intelligible, but only at the sensory level. That is intelligible, that is perfectly, if I want to put it this way, apprehensible without being in the least bit comprehended. Okay, let's see if we can try to put this together with some of Kant's own phrasing now in terms of the harmony of the imagination and the understanding for what Kant's going to be arguing is in the case, I'll just state it here, and I'm going to unpack it a little bit today, and then I'll unpack it a lot more in the next couple of weeks. But the general thesis is in aesthetic judgments, there is a harmony of the faculty of the imagination with the whole of the faculty of the understanding. That's the way Kant puts it. That is, oh boy, see, it's trouble right away. Give me that look like, you know. Just stepped in mud.
It's good. Okay, no, it's a good look. It's a good look. It helps.
So let me see if I can begin. Normally, the understanding has two aspects to its activities. It has categories and empirical concepts. Categories are rules for the use of ordinary empirical concepts. That is, they're meta-rules. So the activity of the understanding is to take an intuitional manifold that's going to be fed into it, and to bring it under concepts that are governed by the categories. So, for example, and this works at two levels. Right? We talked about this already. There has to be a match between the level of judgment, S is P, the table is brown, right? And the way in which the table refers to an object in the world, and says of it, that brownness holds of it. So a judgment is a way of articulating a presentational manifold so that manifold has conceptual content. It's not an image, it's the image as articulated by, right, the subject predicate form, which itself in categorical terms is substance and property. So when
the imagination prepares an object, and prepares the object by work of synthesis, it takes that manifold and begins to think of it as looking for something that will be the substance, right, and its significant properties, in order that the understanding can kick in and say what that substance is and what that property that holds of it is. Now, the important point here is in this work, the imagination is being the whole time, as it were, anticipating what's going to happen in the judgment. That everything about the imaginative work is anticipating that the judgment is going to want to talk in subject-predicate terms. And therefore, because the judgment is going to want to talk in subject-predicate terms, because that's conceptual content, right, then we've got to synthesize the manifold so that there's something that subject terms can refer to, an object, and something that can be said of it, a property. And only in light of the way in which those two things hook together does the manifold, which, I mean, an image is nothing. An image is just pictorial stuff, what Sellers calls the given. And from the given, you get nothing. I mean, there's nothing there until we begin to consider it in some way as relevant to our capacities for conceptualization. Okay. So in this effort, the understanding is that which applies concepts to objects under the guidance of the demands of the category. So the whole work of the imagination is for the sake of conceptualization, so that, and here's the point I'm trying to get to, trying to deal with Kylie's look of disdain or contempt or whatever it was. Normally, we're not talking about the faculty of the understanding in harmony with the faculty of the imagination. We're talking about the way in which a particular intuitive content is presented for conceptualization by the understanding. What the understanding does is conceptualize. So our puzzle now is when we talk about the faculty of the imagination in harmony with the faculty of the understanding, what we're trying to understand is what on earth is the faculty of the understanding when it's not conceptualizing? What on earth is the faculty of the imagination when it's not presenting an object to be conceptualized? So Kant's whole theory is mere reflection is about the harmony between understanding and imagination. Only again, not for the sake of cognition. And because not for the sake of cognition, not for the sake of conceptualization, now we're going to talk about simply the relationship between the faculties as a whole. And what that means is what we're going to be teasing out over the next 2-3 weeks. Is that a little bit better? A little bit better. So Kant says, first introduction still. So we're still reading the bit of the book he never published. We have not yet managed to get. Oh, God. Page 220 at the very bottom of the page in the first introduction.
So that's paragraph 7.
Yeah. So paragraph 20 gives you that story that I've been talking about, where he says spontaneous cognitive powers are apprehension, comprehension, and exhibition. And then after he does all that, he says, so on the bottom of page 220, but when we merely reflect, right, that's what we're interested in now, mere reflection on a perception, we are not dealing, with a determinate concept, but are dealing only with the general rule for reflecting on a perception for the sake of understanding as a power of concepts. Clear as mud, right? But this is the hard bit. This is mere reflection. Clearly then. I love it. You must remember that as a trick, right? Right? Something totally obscure, and then you can say, clearly then. Philippe does it all the time. Yeah, there he is. Clearly then. In a merely reflective judgment, imagine and understanding are considered as they must relate in general in the power of judgment, as compared with how they actually relate in the case of a given perception. So what his hypothesis is here is that in the case of an aesthetic reflective judgment, what we get is the general harmony of the power of the imagination in relationship to the power of the understanding as it might be displayed in considering some object in general. And he further wants to say that, so it's as if what's going on in aesthetic reflective judgment is, instead of getting a sense of the object, we're getting a sense of how these two faculties live together. So normally what we examine is their products, right? But now what we're suddenly doing is turning our attention to the machinery of product production. And we're kind of becoming fascinated by the general powers of that machinery. How it operates, how you have these two very, very different faculties. One of them you may say all head, the other all heart, and how yet they coordinate or harmonize with one another in general. And furthermore, in this general harmony, we're looking for a particular kind of harmony, namely an ideal one. So he goes on to say in the next paragraph, so if the form of an object given an empirical intuition is of such a character that the apprehension in the imagination of the manifold agrees with the exhibition of a concept of the understanding, which concept this is being indeterminate, then imagination and understanding are in mere reflection and mutual harmony. And in this harmony, what happens in this harmony? You may say, if we're not going to recognize anything, what's going to happen? He said, what's going to happen is, in mutual harmony, it's a harmony that furthers the task of these powers. And the object is perceived as purposive. I'm not going to go through all that, because that will really get you crazy. But it's as if, although we're not looking for a cognition of an object,
we nonetheless go through the kind of activities that we would go through under a normal case of cognition, but now with no concepts, no recognition in a concept. And therefore, what's at stake is merely the way in which what is presented allows the imagination to function in a way that is ideally in harmony with the needs of the understanding in general. And the needs of the understanding in general are the needs for unity and complexity. Let's just use that kind of classical aesthetic formula. We need to make it more complex, but let's use that for the time being. So there are two theses here. On the one hand, the perception so considered is one that energizes or releases the relationship between the imagination and the understanding. And because it does so, it reveals the relation between the faculties. So what I mean by this is something like this, that in aesthetic perception, we routinely say that it is an act of absorptive looking. It is extended acts of attention. It is a form of appraising, another word for judgment itself, a form of appraising an object in a way that brings a sense of the coherence of that object as a mere sensible particular. What I'm going to say in a moment is that when we find such unity, we feel a distinct form of pleasure. So, finding this harmony, finding that we're capable of, as it were, holding this messy pollock and suddenly seeing in it a utterly hypnotic pattern of energized relatedness, that in which both the notion of movement and stasis, which is how I think you should think about pollock, are in themselves in reciprocal balance with one another, right? That every notion of movement in pollock is part of a structure that holds the whole as a standing piece. That as we go through those ways of examining it and getting, as it were, we, as it were, feel a distinct pleasure. That pleasure we're feeling is going to be thought of as the pleasure in the harmony of the imagination and the understanding. Well, much more complicated. Yeah.
I have a question about the concept that's exhibited being indeterminate.
Ah, yeah.
Does the understanding want to use a concept and is being retarded from doing so? Or in apprehending and exhibiting in this way, it doesn't want to do that because it wishes to further play, or is there an element of...
All those cases are possible.
Right, okay.
Sometimes, especially if you're a botanist, you have to force yourself to say, wait a minute, you know, enough of pistils and stamens, right? Shh! That's a beautiful rose. You know, you've got to stop yourself from conceptualizing because your natural inclination is to. The reason... And I have a whole long story about this, which we'll get to maybe at some point in the semester. The reason why, for us, abstract art has such power is because it's a case that doesn't allow the conceptual stuff to get going. That, in fact, the whole game of avant-garde art is trying to make sure that conceptualization and interpretation can't get a grip so that you're forced to engage aesthetically, right? So that much of modern art is really about a locating, a reminder of the aesthetic against our tremendous powers, since we're all post-Nietzscheans, of interpretation. That we think we can interpret anything. And we can, right? That's why all art dies, right? Because eventually we learn how to interpret it and we no longer can see it. There are certain polyps, obviously lavender mist. I know it so well, I can barely see it anymore. Right? It almost looks like a pretty bonbon. Right? Now, it is very pretty, but I mean, when he made it, people weren't thinking it's a pretty thing. They were thinking this is outrageous, right? Incomprehensible. Now it just looks easy. Huh, that's all you can do, Pollock? You gotta, you know, bring it on. Right? Gotta do tougher than that if you're gonna make me aestheticize. So we're going to have a story about this, but there's no one way in which the aesthetic arises. It arises sometimes spontaneously, sometimes we work at it, sometimes it hits us. I mean, also, and in Kant's story, however, it is important to say that Kant's story is a story that wants the judgment of taste to be something that is democratically distributed, by which I mean that even children are capable of finding things beautiful. They may not be able to sustain it, or they may not know what it means, but you know, they could be struck by beauty. And that means that it's an examination of something that can occur as well as something we can cultivate. And there's a lot of questions about it. Okay. On the other hand, what about the object? The object so given is going to be specified eventually as what we attend to is the form of the object. So this is kind of Kantian formalism. And we're interested in form here because roughly form is what apprehension apprehends, right? Apprehension doesn't apprehend content. It apprehends ideally spatial, but all sorts of formal relationships. Now, because the object occasions this harmony, it must be considered as if its form were purposive for our faculties. It is, in other words, as if the object is has a perfect fit with the structure of the faculties in general. So that when an object strikes us like that, we think of it as purposive for our powers of judgment. So the manifold apprehended by the imagination is discerned to possess a form, something I've said that's schema-like, which is imaginatively suitable for the work of the understanding in general. But something being schema-like is just what the understanding requires. So the imagination, in synthesizing the manifold as schema-like, is nonetheless working at the behest of the understanding, although the understanding is not demanding anything of the imagination, and it's not demanding anything of the imagination because it's not trying to conceptualize. It's not trying to bring the intuition under a concept. It's just letting the imagination do its work. So Kant will say, in a puzzling formula that will need massive unpacking, that not only is there a harmony between the imagination and the understanding, but there is a free play in the relationship between the imagination and the understanding, as opposed to the case of conceptualization, which is not free play at all. Right? That's business. That's not play. That's work. That's the understanding determining the imagination to go in search of the right kind of unities and bring them home so it can be conceptualized. That's the game. So it is precisely in virtue of its ability to occasion the production of such a form that the object is deemed purposive for judgment. Two side comments. First, notice here that somehow, and this is an area of huge debate, it's what I've been kind of flagging from the get-go, that aesthetic reflective judgments are somehow connected to the demands of cognition. It's cognition without concept. Something's going on here that's related to cognition. And teasing that out is one of the hardest things we need to do. And as I'll show you in the second half, there's a real area of debate here. Secondly, just to open up a field, notice that because for Kant, judgments of taste are non-conceptual, that ideally this is the judgment, this is beautiful, then his fundamental object is nature, not art. And that strikes us as if anything's 18th century-ish about Kant, we may say, whoa, an aesthetics based on the aesthetics of nature? One of the things that I take to be a challenge for the next 10 weeks, that's all we've got left, kind of gets shorter, is to convince you that maybe it being about nature in the first instance is a good thing, not a terrible thing. The other subtext I want to mention, which I've already done by using Pollock, is that this very non-conceptual character of Kantian aesthetics has made Kantian aesthetics suddenly appear tremendously ideal for modernist art. So the greatest of all modernist critics, Clement Greenberg, when he eventually laid out his aesthetic theory, turned out not to be his at all, just turned out to be a commentary on the Third Critique. These are the lectures he gave in Bennington in what, was it 64? Anyway, all the writings of Greenberg show a certain deep Kantian formalism. Now this, of course, is exactly what his postmodern critics hated about Greenberg. Exactly that he was a Kantian formalist. So the stakes here are huge. Okay. I've said that the judgment is non-cognitive. Why call it aesthetic? What do we mean by aesthetic in this setting? What's the relationship between mere reflection or reflective judgment and an aesthetic reflective judgment? Certainly, we've already got the idea that a judgment of taste is non-cognitive, even anti-cognitive. You must withdraw, not, attempt to put the object under concepts. In the first introduction, page 223, one says something. He says two bits of 223 are relevant here. First of all, at the beginning of the page, he says, but we can also consider the same relation between these two cognitive powers merely subjectively. Namely, insofar as one of these powers furthers or hinders the other in one and the same presentation and thereby affects one's mental state. So that we consider this relation as one that can be sensed, as does not happen in the case of the separate use of any cognitive power other than judgment. So on the one hand, the first thing he will say is the aesthetic is when we're judging an object as beautiful, what we are in fact ultimately interested in is not a feature of the object, but the way in which the object affects our capacities for judgment. So that it's about the subjective features of our relationship to the object, rather than as features of the object. Further, after lots of interesting stuff, so the thought here is that in an aesthetic reflective judgment, we're not seeking a determination of the object, but the determination of the subject and of his or her feelings. That is, what we are inquiring into in an aesthetic reflective judgment is not how things stand with the object as such, but how the object is experienced by the subject with respect to its powers of cognition generally. That is, it's a turn from looking at the world to, in a sense, looking at how the world affects or is experienced by us in a fundamental way. And this has two aspects. On the one hand, the question is how the two powers of cognition, the understanding and the imagination, mesh or fail to mesh in considering the object. So the question is, do they harmonize or not? And secondly, this is terribly important, our awareness of that harmonizing or the failures of it, our displeasure. So I'm putting the matter this way because a judgment of taste is not, and I'm going to say a lot about this in the next hour, a raw feel. Right? It's not as if you look at something and are caused to feel pleasure. Right? It is the upshot of both a relationship between our faculties and an awareness of that relationship and of a certain kind of meaningfulness it has. I'm going to say a meaningfulness that is normative. So Kant says, let me put this another way, just to make it easier. There is no phenomenologically identifiable thing called aesthetic pleasure.
aesthetic pleasure you don't recognize in the way you recognize a feeling of burning or a sensation of greenness, right? The kind of pleasure that one gets in an aesthetic episode is involved in a certain context and involves both reflective capacities and intentional understandings, however implicit. But I'm going to say there's a level of complexity here that is ingredient in the judgment. And therefore, it is not, despite the fact that it's subjective, despite the fact that it's about pleasure, despite the fact that it's at the sensory level, despite all that, it's got to have a particular kind of intentional complexity to rise to the level of a reflective judgment. Nonetheless, that said, what makes it an aesthetic judgment is that the determining ground, absolutely clear, the determining ground of aesthetic reflective judgment is a feeling of pleasure. Kant says at 224, hence we may define an aesthetic judgment. Here, fourth week, which has been waiting weeks, hours, decades to know what the definition of aesthetic judgment is. Well, here's one. Here we may define an aesthetic judgment in general as one whose predicate can never be cognition, that is a concept of an object, though it may contain subjective conditions for cognition as such. In such a judgment, the basis determining it is sensation. There is, however, only one so-called sensation that can never become a concept of an object. It's a wonderful claim. There's only one sensation that can never become the concept of an object, the feeling of pleasure and displeasure. This sensation is merely subjective, whereas all other sensations can be used for cognition. So the thought of all other sensations are sensations of red, cold, rough, bright. All of these, right? Can be turned back into an account of the object. However they're felt, they are, as it were, feelings that are feelings of a feature of something in the world. Right? Sometimes they're relative, sometimes they're relational, but they refer to something in the world. And therefore they have an aboutness of the object. Pleasure is about how I feel. And therefore, an aesthetic reflective judgment is a response by me to the experience of the object in reflection. Now, and I'll do this and then I'll stop and we'll have a break. But I can't resist doing it. The notion of pleasure that Kant uses, of course, is far from transparent. And on pages 230, 231, he offers a transcendental definition of pleasure. It occurs just at the beginning of that new paragraph where he says, a definition of this feeling in general terms.
without considering the distinction as to whether it accompanies sensation proper or accompanies reflection or the determination of the will. So we're just getting rid of, notice the three things he's just mentioned are various ways we can feel pleasure. That is, it can accompany a sensation proper. So I can feel both that something tastes sweet, like the chocolate, and that the sensation of that sweetness is pleasurable. Right? That's one type of taste. Or accompanies reflection. That's what we're talking about. Or thirdly, the determination of the will. The pleasure of... it's the pleasure of achieving an end. So I bring something into existence. So the pleasure of achieving a purpose. Say, finishing your essay on Kant. Whoa, massive. We I know you call it relief, but it's a form of pleasure. We're ignoring those distinctions, and we just want to think about it transcendentally, which in this case means with respect to the fundamental powers of the human being for our capacity to encounter objects in the world. I think that's what transcendental means here. Levine, is that right, you think?
Yes.
Good. And it reads, pleasure is, and it's a two-part definition, the two parts are immensely important because one part doesn't appear explicitly in the published introduction, and yet it's crucial for the understanding of the text as a whole. So, pleasure is a mental state in which a presentation, so that's something in the imagination, intuitive presentation, is in harmony with itself, and which is the basis either for merely preserving this state itself, for the state in which the mental powers further one another in a presentation preserves itself, or for producing the object of this presentation. Okay, that's clear as mud, right? The two possibilities. And then I'll just say this, and then we'll see what we can do with it later on, is either we get a pleasure from being in the state of, say, a harmony of the faculties, and in being in that state, the pleasure is connected to the intrinsic character of that state in wanting to preserve itself. So that state is both cause and effect of itself. It is something that feeds on itself. So, oh, don't look at me like that. You're looking ready to cry. How do I want to say this? It's as if there are certain moments when you are looking at a picture or listening to a bit of music and you can't tear yourself away. What is that about? What is holding you there? And Kant's answer is there's a certain type of pleasure that the character of that pleasure is it means to be sustaining for the life of the mind. That being in that state is what it's like to have a mind at all, one feels. It's almost as if this is what it's like to be alive, I'm going to say later. That's one kind of state, that we be in a self-maintaining mode. The second kind of state is where the presentation, right, is a ground for the production of an object, by which he means nothing more than I have an idea and I build the Empire State Building.
Right.
The presentation is the basis of a desire
to produce an object in the world, which would give me, so it's a source of desire, which then is satisfied by the production of the object. Okay.
Now, clearly, for reasons we'll come to, aesthetic pleasure is not of the latter kind. So what on earth is aesthetic pleasure? What is this stuff about self-maintaining states? Is it pleasure at all? Does Kant really find pleasure in aesthetic objects? And worse, is it really disinterested? Stop there. Let's have a break. We have lots of questions. Tell me about it.
Okay.
You think it's tough from your angle?
Can I talk to you?